Chapter 19. Skippy expertly guided the package down to splat half on the kelp mat and half in a mud puddle to my left. "What is this, Skippy?"
"Balloons, Joe. They will lift you out of there."
"Balloons? You also included a parachute, right?"
"No, dum-dum, a parachute would add too much weight."
"I need a parachute in case the Theranans shoot down the balloons and I need to go skydiving, Skippy."
"You don't need a parachute to go skydiving, Joe."
"I don't?"
"No, you need a parachute to go skydiving more than once,"
he laughed.
"Anyway, get moving."
I had to swim on top of the mud, floating as best I could with the flight suit inflated to its maximum. With the torso, arms, and legs puffed out, I looked like the Michelin Man. That was better than being Barney, I guess, and the extra surface area spread my weight out to keep me from sinking faster. As I moved in an awkward frog-like swimming motion, the kelp mat shifted and began breaking up, pulling me down into the sticky mud.
"How's it going, Joe?"
Skippy asked cheerily. I knew he was dying for me to praise the clever way he delivered the package to me, and I had to give him props, because it had accurately landed near me after being ejected from a Falcon at over 40,000 meters altitude.
"Your part of the plan was perfectly awesome as expected, Skippy. I am not doing so well."
"Why not?" he demanded.
"Let's just say my prospects aren't sinking at the moment."
I moved my arms more vigorously as my boots began sinking into the mud quicker. Kicking my legs only made it worse, as it created pockets in the mud that got filled in with watery mud. Using only my arms, I swam as smoothly as possible toward the package until I touched it with my fingertips. Holding my legs rigid so they didn't move at all, I pulled the package toward me. It was enveloped in an inflated life vest that the aircrew must have wrapped in what looked like a lot of duct tape.
"Skippy, is this thing wrapped in duct tape? That does not boost my confidence."
"It's not duct tape. Okay, it is basically high-tech duct tape. The crew had to use whatever they could find, and there wasn't a lot of time, because some whiny a-hole on the ground named Joe was bitching at them to hurry up." Crap. My knife was in a holster at my right ankle. That did not reflect good planning by me. I grunted.
"What's wrong now, Joe?"
"I need a knife to cut open this duct tape, Skippy, and my knife is at my boot under the mud." Pulling my right foot up made that knee sink deeper in the clinging mud.
"Oh, for... Joe, you truly are a dumb monkey. I swear, your ancestors were the ones who were too stupid to climb a tree when they saw a leopard. It is amazing they survived to create you."
"I am feeling pretty darn stupid now, Skippy." My fingers finally touched the knife and I quickly pulled it out. By then, my right thigh was completely encased by thick mud and my hip was sinking.
"Cutting it open now."
"Got it," I reported, and the life vest unfolded, exposing the package inside. I stopped caring about not sinking deeper into the mud because it was happening anyway, so I focused on getting the package open. First, I took out the harness and strapped myself in. It took some awkward gymnastics to get the lower part of the harness around my legs and crotch, and by the time I was done, I was completely up to my waist in mud. Flinging my arms out didn't slow the mud pulling me down. The kelp I had been laying on was broken apart and mixed into the mud.
"Whatever you're gonna do, do it now," I shouted as the mud sucked at me, and I was suddenly submerged to my armpits.
The package exploded upward with a soft puff, and three nearly invisible balloons began inflating. Skippy triggered the balloons in sequence to avoid them becoming tangled with each other. Two of the lines still got wrapped together, but that didn't matter.
"You are sure this is going to work?"
I asked anxiously as the mud reached the chin of my helmet.
"No. Duh. How the hell can I be sure? This has never been done before. These balloons are designed to hold only the tether line aloft, so it can be engaged by a dropship and pull a soldier off the ground, like how the Spec Ops teams got off those rooftops on Kobamic, or how they were supposed to get off the rooftops until some beer can jumped the gun and screwed up the whole mission. Anywho, this should work fine, in theory. These tether balloons are capable of operating in thin atmospheres. They can inflate much more than the setting we used on Kobamic. Three of them, fully inflated, should be able to lift you off the surface, except...
It's not working. You should be flying through the air like Superman by now."
"I do not understand."
"It's the mud, Skippy. I'm stuck in it." It was hard to talk with my neck tilted all the way back, lifting the bottom opening of the faceplate just above the mud. As I spoke, a thin trickle of mud poured into the helmet.
Oh, crap, I should have thought of that. Move your arms and legs to create space in the mud while I deflate the life vest.
Deflate? I asked in panic, but I should have trusted the awesomeness. Flailing my limbs and suddenly deflating the life vest created short-lived pockets in the mud. The pockets quickly filled in, not quick enough as I was jerked upward. There was a sucking sound, then a pop as my legs broke free. And then I was soaring through the air.
The Theranin are shooting at you, Joe. Their aim sucks. You are in no danger from those morons, that's for sure.
I should relax and enjoy the ride? I asked with a gulp as the stiff breeze caught me and I was pulled to the right, then left. The tethers had stabilizers along their lengths, but with three of them tangled together, their stabilizers were useless. It was going to be a rough ride. I reminded myself that the only thing that mattered was I was rising up away from the mud that had almost drowned me, and that the prevailing wind was carrying me to the southwest, away from the Theranin, and that the Theranin couldn't shoot worth shit. Okay, that's three things that mattered.
Poppin' away in my beautiful balloon.
Skippy wobbled out of tune.
For we can fly, we can fly.
Swinging wildly back and forth in the gusty breeze below the balloons, I was getting nauseous.
I do not feel like I'm flying right now, Skippy. I feel like I'm skidding across the sky out of control.
You don't like that song?
In 1937, Leadbelly had a song about the Hindenburg. I could sing that one instead.
No. No singing about exploding blimps, I shouted while looking up at the flimsy things holding me in the air.
Hm, he sniffed. The Hindenburg did not explode, Joe. That is a myth. The problem was the coating on the exterior.
Don't care, Skippy. Do not care. No more talking about exploding or burning or anything that involves something going wrong and me spiraling down back into the mud.
Come on, Joe. You won't fall back into the mud.
Yeah. Thank...
You're over the original shoreline now. The danger to you would be getting fatally impaled on a tree.
You are such a comfort to me, Skippy.
I choked on the words as a gust of wind jerked me up, then violently down. A thermal caught the balloons, and I zoomed upward so fast it felt like my stomach fell into my boots. The ground fell away below me, and I concentrated on keeping my last meal inside my stomach while the ride smoothed out and the gut-churning swaying back and forth damped down. Eventually, I was able to relax and enjoy the view. In a short time, I was high enough that the visual fuzz of the odd stealth field covering the surface of Gingerbread began to obscure my view in all directions except straight down. Soon, I thought with relief, I would be far enough away from the lake for a falcon to zip down and retrieve me. Unless they were Theranin far away from the lake, which was possible, although our drones had not detected any evidence of Theranin or any sentient species beyond several kilometers from that now partly drained body of water.
Skippy, you sure?
I swallowed hard, suddenly struggling for breath. Taking a deep breath through my nose, I sniffed to learn if there was some airborne toxin or if smoke from the battles below was affecting my ability to breathe. Then I looked down below my feet, where the trees of the forest had blurred into featureless green fuzz. Pulling off a glove, I looked at my fingernails. They were tinged slightly blue. I was suffering from altitude sickness. No wonder I couldn't breathe.
Skippy, what's my altitude now?
You're at about 7,500 meters.
Why? The air up here is thin, I gasped.
Duh! Damn it, that particular duh was directed at myself. I'm sorry, Joe. I forget you biological trash bags need to breathe constantly. It is very annoying. You should take in concentrated metallic oxygen. All it takes is to compress it to about 1.2 million times the pressure of Earth's atmosphere at the surface. Then you would only need to take in oxygen once a day or so. Really, though, there are several other reactive elements that would be better suited for
air.
I felt myself fading, my vision narrowing to a small area directly in front of my eyes.
Huh?
Oh, yes, damn it. You keep distracting me. I'm partially deflating one of the balloons now. You will be descending shortly. The descent wasn't abrupt, more like an elevator.
I was on the verge of blacking out before I got down to an altitude low enough to breathe comfortably. Part of the problem at high altitude was the muscles required to breathe hard required a lot of oxygen, so it became literally a death spiral. Breathe less vigorously to reduce the body's need for oxygen, and you don't take in enough oxygen. It was my fault for not considering my altitude. I had learned to monitor myself for signs of hypoxia during pilot training. Dangling under a group of flimsy balloons had not seemed like flying, so I hadn't connected what I was doing with what I should be doing. Pilots call that poor situational awareness, and in its many forms it kills more pilots than any other hazard. With Skippy remotely controlling the balloons, alternately inflating and deflating them, he kept me at an altitude where the air was breathable, and I literally hung out in the sky until the lake and the hills around it faded out of view into the hazy fuzz of the stealth field. At that point, I gave permission for a falcon to drop down to retrieve me. They caught the tether smoothly on the first try, but with multiple tethers wrapped around each other, my ride up into the open rear ramp of the falcon was rough. Like, super rough. My brain got bounced around in my skull so hard I was totally useless during the procedure. Finally, I was safely inside the Falcon being held by two crewmen, and the back ramp swung closed.
"How are you, s- oh,"
the crewman wrinkled his nose. "I'm fine." Inside the confines of the dropship, I could smell myself. It was not pleasant. In fact, I almost gagged on the stench. The mud and nasty whatever else clinging to my flight suit had partly dried while I dangled beneath the balloons. Now the smell was concentrated. I had an odor like I'd rolled in cow manure combined with rotting fish.
"Yeah," I replied. "Sorry about the smell. It's pretty bad."
"That smell is just Joe's cologne," Skippy chuckled. I told him that Chanel number 2 was a bad choice, but he didn't listen to me. Breathing through his mouth to avoid smelling me, the crewman looked me over. As I had no obviously broken bones, he asked,
"Can I get you anything, sir?"
And my father used to take Advil and bourbon. He called it Badville. "Got any of that?" Despite the stench I was making in the confined dropship cabin, that drew a smile from him.
"Advil, maybe. We do have," he nodded toward a bundle, "a change of clothes and a washroom."
I took the hint. We tossed my old flight suit out at 15,000 meters. I was sad to see it go, as it had saved my life, but damn! No way were we ever getting that smell out of the fabric. Adams greeted me at the bottom of the ramp when my dropship landed, and while she snapped a salute to me, it looked like she'd been crying, and I could have sworn she wanted to hug me. Maybe somehow I had fallen into a bizarre parallel universe.
"Sergeant," I returned the salute and gave her a big, genuine smile.
"I hear you gave Skippy a pep talk while I was at the bottom of a lake."
"It was more of a pep slap, sir," she responded with a wink.
"I'll pretend I didn't hear that." I took a quick shower and changed into a fresh uniform. By the time I was ready, Smythe's team had landed and they were getting out of their armored suits and stowing their gear. Chotek and Chang were chatting with Smythe. He was giving them a quick overview of the engagement.
"Those drones," Smythe gestured to the open back ramp of a dropship, "are a tremendous advantage to us. The Theranin didn't appear to have any drones of their own, or be able to counter ours, other than random rifle fire."
"You weren't able to leave a drone there to monitor the Theranin?" I asked. Chang and Chotek had been able to partly follow the ground action through the relay data link, while I had almost no idea what Smythe's team had done, since I had been stuck at the bottom of a lake.
"Yes, sir. We left one drone orbiting the area on autopilot, but we don't have access to its data until we send a dropship there."
Smythe shook his head.
"The bandwidth of the data link between here and the lake only allows voice communication or brief data bursts. We can't control the drone from here or receive messages."
"Some of our people were in suits," Chotek observed.
"But you," he looked at me, "and the other pilots in your Dragon were exposed. The Theranin saw you. They know we are human."
"Yes, sir, but these Theranin have been here a long time. Before the wormhole shift that made Earth accessible. They don't know who humans are. All they know is we are unfamiliar aliens."
"Unfamiliar to them," Chotek pressed his point. "They saw us. The Guardians are dormant for the moment.
If those Saranen are able to get a signal beyond this star system, that could be disastrous for humanity.
I don't think that will happen, Skippy entered the conversation. There are active stealth and fuzz fields around this planet. I don't see any reason to think the stealth field surrounding the entire star system has been deactivated. All I did was request the Guardians to stand down.
You don't know for a fact the stealth field is still active, Chotek insisted. You can't know, unless we go outside the system, and we can't do that. Colonel Bishop, how can we be sure those Saranen will not expose our secret?
Well, I started to say, then I smiled. Adams knew what I was thinking.
Oh, come on, sir, you have to say it.
Why, it's not really a pro—
If you don't say it, I will. She stood facing me with hands on her hips. You know you've been waiting for this opportunity.
She was right. No way could I resist.
I say we nuked the site from orbit.
I cocked my head toward Chotek. It's the only way to be sure.
Nuke? Chotek sputtered. You propose to use nuclear weapons on Gingerbread?
He was drowned out by laughter from everyone else around us. The Chinese had seen aliens. The Indians and French had all seen it. Hans Chotek may be the only member of the merry band of pirates who had not seen that movie.
Seriously, what the hell was wrong with that guy?
When the laughter died down, Chotek was fuming.
Colonel Bishop, regardless of Skippy, the Guardians are not likely to stand by while we detonate nuclear—
Oh, shit. There was nothing worse than a guy who didn't get the joke. Sir, that was a joke. It's a line from a movie. I was not going to take the time right then to explain it to him. It's a Soldiers Against Aliens movie. I thought, as I spoke, it sounded lame. Sorry, that was a bad time for a joke. Skippy, can a signal get out through the fuzz and stealth fields around this planet?
No way, Jose, he declared.
Then, because he probably had caught on that Chotek was in no mood for humor, he added, No, Colonel Joe. That is something I can be certain of. Unless the Theranin have a dropship stashed away somewhere, they'll never get a signal beyond the atmosphere.
Good. I thought that issue was settled. Then Skippy opened his big fat mouth.
Of course, they must have had a dropship to get here, right? No way could they have brought weapons and combots and escape pods.
Hey, he added happily, now that I'm thinking about it, we are flying dropships around willy-nilly. The Guardians aren't stopping anyone from flying. It's unlikely the Theranin have managed to keep a dropship flight-worthy over so many years, but, they wouldn't need a dropship. Really, they could just build a crude rocket to get a signal outside this planet's stealth field.
I wanted to choke him. I seriously wanted to wrap my hands around his can and squeeze, even though I knew that wouldn't do anything to that little shithead. Waving my hands to stifle the alarmed murmuring going on around me, I spoke quickly to prevent Chotek from doing something stupid.
Sir, if we can find a conduit to fix Skippy, then we have a chance to get off Gingerbread, and whatever those Theranin here saw won't matter. They'll be stuck here without any way to communicate with the outside universe. For now, I think we monitor those Theranin, see if we can find other communities of survivors down here. Possibly survivors from the Rindaloo Coalition, I suggested. They might be useful to us rather than hostile.
That last remark I added because I knew the thought of finding allies would please Chotek, even if those allies had been trapped on Gingerbread for hundreds or thousands of years and would be entirely useless to help Earth now.
Other survivors? Chotek's eyes lit up.
Yes, sir. Skippy, those Theranin. Have you figured out when they got here?
No, dum-dum, I don't have enough data yet.
My guess is they are from the last recorded expedition to the Roach Motel 417 years ago.
More than 400 years?
I couldn't contain my shock.
How could they have survived all that time?
They couldn't. Not all of them, anyway. The Theranin have a sort of hibernation ability that can help stretch out their lifespan, and it is possible they have not been on Gingerbread for the past 417 years. Assuming their ship was destroyed, they might have spent centuries drifting through space in deep sleep before landing here. Without more data, any speculation is useless, he reminded me in an annoyed tone.
Wait for me to collect data.
Data, right.
Sir, I looked at Chotek, who had a faraway look.
No doubt he was imagining himself meeting survivors from many civilizations on Gingerbread, negotiating with them, and bringing a comprehensive peace treaty back to Earth. I imagined myself sprouting wings and flying around like an angel. My wish was more likely to happen. We do need more data. We need to continue the survey missions. When Chotek lifted an eyebrow skeptically, I added, "The survey flights will all be conducted by 2 aircraft in stealth. We will be looking for evidence of conduits and of survivors. With the surface shrouded in a fuzz field, survey flights are the only way to know what is out there." That got a nod from my boss. "Very well, Colonel Bishop. I want a ground combat team with each survey flight in case of difficulties." "Yes, sir," I assured him. "We will have 1 aircraft low running scans and 1 flying high cover." That was going to cut in half the number of survey flights we would conduct and seriously eat into our dwindling fuel supply, but I agree we could no longer send out single ships. We needed to find a working conduit soon. Skippy called me when I was clearing brush to create a dropship landing zone closer to base camp. "Hey, Joe, when we first started flying recon missions, you asked me about the meteor impact craters on Gingerbread." "Oh, yeah. Sorry about that, Skippy. I knew you were busy. I shouldn't have bothered you with trivia." "No, you got that wrong, Joe. You should have bugged me about it. If you had, I might have noticed something important earlier." "Ah, actually, if you had bugged me about it, I would have been extra stubborn and refused to do anything. Anyway, I did look into the data, and I found something interesting. There are a lot of impact craters, Joe, and some of them are relatively recent." "Lots of meteors in this star system, huh?" "No, the opposite. That's what caused me to look deeper into the data. This system has a thin asteroid belt. Suspiciously thin. I expect the Elders mined most of the asteroids for raw materials, so an asteroid field could not be the source of an unusually large number of meteors. Next, I turned my attention to the Oort cloud using data from the Dutchman's sensors. There wasn't a lot of data to work with, but I could see clearly the cloud is thin and stable. There aren't a lot of comets swinging around the inner system here."
Okay.
I had no idea where he was going with the conversation. "Really, it makes sense that there isn't a lot of dangerous space junk floating around this system. Except for broken starships, I mean. Gingerbread was an Elder colony. They would have cleaned up any dangerous space rocks and either sent them into the star or ejected them from the system. Or used the raw materials for construction."
"They cleaned up the space rocks, so where did all the meteor impacts come from?"
"Those craters were not caused by meteor impacts, Joe. Remember the craters I found on Barsoom?"
"Oh, shit. Again?"
"Worse. What happened here was more destructive, and that isn't the worst thing I found. Barsoom is essentially a dead world, so the craters there have rested almost untouched since they were created. Gingerbread is a living planet with rain and weather and erosion and plants sinking roots into the soil, and that confused me for a while. Now that I'm focusing on the data, I can see the smaller craters were made by relativistic impactors. Tiny rocks moving half the speed of light, I guessed. Something like that, although certainly not crude rocks and maybe not moving quite that fast. The larger craters, the ones I suspect scooped out entire cities or other substantial facilities, were created by transitioning a sphere-shaped area out of phase into another space-time. That's kind of overkill, in my opinion."
"I thought you said overkill is underrated."
"Well, that's true when I'm doing it, Joe. If the Elders wanted to ensure the tech in their cities did not get touched by grubby aliens, there are more sophisticated, less energy-intensive ways of doing it."
"Maybe someone was showing off."
"Ah, maybe. What worries me is another possibility. An energy-intensive method was used because someone wanted the cities removed quickly, or worse, removed in a hostile manner."
"Crap.
Oh, man," I gasped at the implication. "That's not good. You think those big craters weren't the Elders picking up stuff before they left? You think those cities were destroyed in an attack?"
"I do.
My analysis shows the large craters are roughly the same age as the craters on Barsoom, about 100 million years."
"Whoa.
What was humanity doing 100 million years ago?"
"Oh, that's right, nothing.
That was, wait, I know this one, because dinosaurs are cool.
100 million years ago was during the Cretaceous period that ended with the extinction of the dinosaurs. My memory is vague, but I think the Cretaceous was when birds and flowering plants first evolved and... Okay, I kind of got off the subject there. Some bad shit happened on Gingerbread back then. Not just back then, Joe. That's the worst part. The big craters are all old, and of the same age. Some of the smaller impact craters date back to that same time, but I found a couple as recent as 6,000 years ago. It looks like something or someone has been regularly bombarding the surface of Gingerbread over the last few million years. Regularly. On Earth, we have meteor showers the same time every year when our orbit passes through... Yes, yes, he dismissed my comment irritably. I should not have said regularly. I should have said periodically. There was a big cluster of impacts about 100 million years ago, then nothing, until about the same time Newark was thrown out of orbit. After that, there is another gap. Then, starting about 1 million years ago, I see impacts scattered randomly across the timeline. Artificial impacts? Someone cleaning up Elder sites they missed the first time by blowing them up from orbit? I do not think that is likely, Joe. The first set of impacts, 100 million years ago, could have been for the purpose of destroying leftover Elder sites. But the cluster of impacts around the time disaster struck Newark must be something different. And then there are smaller impacts widely scattered in time. For example, there is a cluster of craters 700 kilometers to the south of here that I have dated approximately 200,000 years ago. He showed me a graphic with the timeline of impacts. There was no pattern to them. At this point, he continued, I do not have any clue what the data is telling me. I do have a nagging feeling this is important, that I am not simply digging into useless ancient history trivia. I will continue to analyze the data and see if I can puzzle out what it means. Right then, all I cared about was that someone wasn't going to drop a relativistic impactor on my own head, but I didn't say that to Skippy. Later I realized I should have told him. Damn, the one time I keep my big mouth shut is the time I should have spoken up. Joe! Skippy's voice startled me awake. The sound was coming from the Z-phone earpiece under my pillow, or the rolled-up sweater I was using as a pillow on my cot. What? I held the earpiece to my ear and glanced at my Z-phone. Damn it. He woke me up at 0413. Gingerbread's day was 26.5 Earth hours, so I was hoping for an extra hour of sleep before I was scheduled to fly as co-pilot on a recon mission. This couldn't have waited, I whispered to avoid disturbing people around me in the shelter. No such luck. The people were all combat veterans, and they became instantly awake when they heard the distressed tone of my voice. I waved that everything was all right, and heads dropped back down. Along with waking quickly, elite soldiers had developed the ability to fall back asleep just as quickly. It could have waited, sure, but your bladder was going to wake you up in like 10 minutes anyway. You shouldn't have drunk a whole canteen full of water before going to sleep. Damn it. Now that I was sitting up, I knew he was right. Give me a minute. After visiting the latrine, I wandered away from base camp after texting the two guards on duty what I was doing. There was a flat rock overlooking a stream. I sat on the rock and listened to the water splashing along. With a bare zephyr of an early morning breeze rustling the leaves unseen in the darkness above me, I could easily imagine myself on Earth. It even smelled the same. Damp soil, the fresh scent of moving water, and something very much like pine needles.
Okay, I'm reasonably awake. What is it?
You sure you don't want to grab a cup of coffee first? Captain Jerome made a fresh pot less than an hour ago.
No coffee.
I was hoping to crawl back in my cot soon. Joe, you get cranky when...
You want to see what cranky looks like?
No... Okay, I can tell somebody needs more sleep. Anywho, I found something interesting in the survey flight center data. Two interesting things, actually.
Interesting, like, dangerous? Because if not, I'm going to get some more rack time. Crap, I was supposed to run with the Chinese team at 0630.
I think I found a conduit. Hearing that made me sit up straight. Where? Before we get into that, let me tell you what else I found. I think I know why there are impact craters almost randomly over the past 1 million years. There isn't any pattern to them, but then I realized the dates match up with dates in another data set. Like?
I was hoping you would try to guess.
He sounded disappointed.
Then I would have the joy of mocking you unmercifully.
Not without coffee, Skippy.
Ugh, fine.
Look at your phone. The first chart shows the timeline of impacts. The second chart, I am now overlaying, shows the known expeditions to the Roach Motel.
Holy shit, I gasped.
Most of the dots representing times when ships were sent on one-way trips into the Roach Motel did not have matching dots on the timeline of impact craters on Gingerbread, but almost all of the impact craters matched up with known times ships were sent in.
The events that don't match up are
very likely expeditions I do not know about, yes, he finished the thought for me.
Good. Good. So these impact craters, they can't be from debris when the Guardians destroyed trespassing ships, right?
No, the Guardians do not use kinetic weapons.
Then what caused the craters? Why are there craters sometimes and not others?
Do you want to guess?
He asked eagerly.
Again, not without coffee.
You are such a party pooper, Joe.
Okay, fine.
He said fine the way women do when things are anything but fine.
I believe the impact craters are from the Guardians wiping out groups of survivors on Gingerbread.
Crap. Now I was awake, without needing coffee.
They're not doing that to us.
No, Joe, they will not harm us. I am still able to keep them quiet, although that is growing more difficult by the day.
Great. Hey, if the Guardians nuke people who managed to land on Gingerbread, then why haven't they hit that pain-in-the-ass group of Theranin?
My theory is the Guardians only react when a group of survivors uses a technology the Guardians view as a potential threat, like generating power over a certain limit, or flying above a certain altitude, or using weapons. That is why those Theranin were so bad at shooting, Joe. I don't think they had actually fired a weapon since they landed. Somehow they must have figured out they can only use a minimum level of technology, or the Guardians will pound them to dust.
Whew! I whistled as I looked at the chart on my Z-phone.
That's, I counted, 14. 14 different impact events over the past million years.
Wow, 14 groups of survivors managed to land on Gingerbread.
16, counting us and the last group of Theranin, Joe. And that doesn't count groups who landed but could not survive here. If a group of survivors did not have the ability to grow their own food, they would not have lasted long.
Good point.
That reminded me that Chotek had been pressing for recon flights to concentrate on looking for sites to build a permanent settlement rather than continuing the fruitless task of searching for Skippy's elusive conduit thing.
Back to the conduit. Where is it?
My Z-phone display changed from a chart to a map.
3,800 kilometers from here, Joe.
Underground, there is a series of natural caverns and, more importantly, extensive artificial tunnels. From the type of installation that used to be on the surface, I know there is a conduit under the ground. Or there was one.
Used to be?
Yes, there used to be a large complex on the surface. Based on its configuration, I can tell it facilitated linking conduits. There must have been a conduit under the surface, probably several conduits.
Must have been. Used to be.
You don't know?
I can't see the damned thing, Joe.
His frustration was evident.
What I can tell you is that if there is a conduit on Gingerbread, this is where we'll find it, or we won't.
It's that simple.
Got it.
We're going, then.
You will come with us.
Absolutely.
His cheeriness was back.
The last thing we want is a bunch of monkeys poking around in scary dark places without me.
Uh-huh. Because the last time you went poking around in a scary dark place, it worked out great for everyone.
Oh, shut up.
Colonel Bishop, called the voice from behind me.
Captain Giraud, I asked, surprised.
Skippy told me you wanted coffee, sir.
His expression made it clear he did not appreciate being requested to fetch coffee.
No, Skippy wants me to drink coffee.
Ah, crap, Captain, I'm sorry.
Now that I am here, he said with a Gallic shrug, holding up two mugs of coffee.
Ah, sure. I patted the rock. Sit down. How are you? I knew Giraud and the entire French team had finally been declared ready to return to duty, having fully recovered from radiation poisoning when the Flying Dutchman jumped away to ambush a Theranin starship near our captured relay station.
I am well,
he replied brusquely, not seeking chit-chat in the wee small hours of the morning.
and he did not want any more inquiries into his health. He had gotten thoroughly tired of people treating him like an invalid.
"Did I hear you say Skippy found the conduit?"